As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Yo, technology, what is it all about?
I think the worry with this tends to be the feedback loops. We don't know which feedback loop might trigger something that makes it very challenging for humans to live in certain areas. That's the much worse part.
Yeah.
And we are initiating a lot of feedback loops that we don't understand.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Danny in the Valley. This week, you all are in for a treat because we are talking about everyone's favorite subject. That's right. Insurance. Just kidding. I kid. Seriously though, insurance. Big industry, super important, makes the whole world go round. And it's in trouble, big trouble, because climate change has made a mess of all kinds of its risk models, which has ruined the finances of whole swathes of the industry, forcing them to take drastic action, whether it's pulling out of markets entirely, jacking up rates, or generally making life miserable for anyone who needs insurance, which in the case of, you know, most of the advanced world is roughly everybody. Anyhow, this week's guest is right at the forefront of those changes that are rippling through the industry. His name is Sid Ja. He's the founder of a company called Arbol Tree in Spanish, which is an insurance startup that leverages vast amounts of climate data to offer so-called parametric insurance, which pays out basically or based on various thresholds being met, whether it's, you know, degrees of heat being met, inches of rainfall, magnitude of earthquakes, etc. Anyhow, Sid comes at this from a really interesting perspective. Before he started Arbol, he was a hedge fund trader. So he was deeply ensconced in that world of, you know, Wall Street trading, getting acquainted with the oceans of data that go into making trades on especially commodities like oil, cattle prices, etc. He started Arbol 6 years ago, and as we discussed, they've come along just at a time when the kind of the centuries-old paradigm of the insurance industry is breaking down. So it is a really fun discussion that will make you think, I promise you, especially when you think about the downstream effects of when climate disasters lead to big payouts, which lead to industry increasing rates, which leads to them stopping offering service altogether, what that means for whole sections of the economy and modern life and how they work today and how that's all changing as we speak. So it's a lot to bite off, but I think you're going to enjoy this discussion. So now I will stop talking and hand you over to my chat with Sid Ja of Arbol. Enjoy. I think it's important that we start with the obvious, which is like, why would we even talk about insurance? Isn't insurance the most boring thing on the planet? Because I think people have, you know, understand insurance often in a kind of more abstract way. What is Arbol and what role does insurance play? How important is it? Because it feels like it's kind of an unseen piece of architecture that, you know, if you remove it, like, you know, lots of buildings fall down, so to speak.
Absolutely. So let's start with insurance. Insurance is a key piece of financial infrastructure that is actually a foundational part of a developed society. And what that means, you know, in the context of day-to-day life is we don't often realize how much of our life is insured and how much resource, capital, mind frame, whatever, it frees us to invest in the future. So if you didn't have home insurance, you would have to set aside quite a bit of money to make sure that if something did happen to your home, you had enough to self-insure. That money then cannot be used for other things. you go to the scale of businesses, you are faced with all sorts of random events that can set you back years. Without insurance, those random events could be a hurricane going through your area, could be a political event, could be all sorts of different issues, someone getting hurt. All these different issues can suddenly set you back years. And without insurance, you really have a difficult time investing in the future because the present is so fraught with risk. And this is something you notice in, you know, less developed sort of financial ecosystems where insurance penetration is very low. A lot of resource has to be spent on self-insurance, and or random events do set back people and businesses years, if at all they can even recover.
You mean self-insurance, you mean basically just saving yourself for a rainy day, basically.
Yeah, which is not a luxury a lot of folks can have.
Yeah. Right?
I grew up in a very different place in India, and I'm from a very less advantaged place in India.
Where are you from?
From Bihar, in the east. So, okay. You know, it's very common to have families that suddenly have either a death of a family member or a drought, and they never recover from it. It just creates a cycle, a perpetual cycle of debt.
And is Bihar an agricultural area?
Yes. Yes.
Gotcha.
You know, call it like 80-90%.
Oh, wow. Is that what you did, or is it your family did growing up?
Yes, they have agricultural lands, basically, yes. And then some parts urbanized over time, but not a lot. So it's like sort of the Gangetic Delta, very,
gotcha.
Very, you know, infused with that agricultural spirit. And when you lack, you know, things like crop insurance, which in the past was not there, you are basically living on the edge every season. So insurance is very key for that. Now, how are we doing it differently? So insurance is also facing a lot of challenges. The way insurance has been administered for the last, call it 100 or so years, you have had an adjuster, somebody comes subjectively to figure out after an event what they want to pay you and how much your actual loss was. And this is a process fraught with delays, disputes, sometimes fraud, litigation, and it's really not a scalable process. It also introduces a tremendous amount of uncertainty for the person purchasing this safety. So you purchase a product, but you don't know when you'll get paid. You don't know how much you'll get paid. And these problems get exacerbated the more complex the insured is, right? When you go from an individual to a business to a corporation, now it can be a multi-year process to figure out how much you actually are owed after a flood or a hurricane, for example. So one of the ways we thought we would scale that gap, because there's a growing coverage gap. You have $200 billion of climate-related losses annually now, approximately, and over half is uncovered by insurance or such vehicles. And so that lack of coverage, and where coverage does exist, it's slow, it's painstaking. You basically have a tremendous amount of uncertainty. And so we thought data would be the way to scale this, that data would allow you to close that coverage gap. So if your triggers can be based on objective external data sets, instead of a person showing up to your farm or business, that could enable you to get transparent, efficient payments.
Will insurance companies want that? Because what it sounds like you're saying is that it's, and this may be a cynical view, but it sounds like you're going to make it easier for insurance companies to pay out, which most people will say, well, that's not what insurance companies want. They want to kind of like find any way to weasel out of it.
Yeah, that is certainly a view. I'm not sure it's even that cynical. there's certainly parts of the industry that work exactly like that. And I have faced that personally. My apartment flooded and it was like a two-year process to like get the actual stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was lucky enough that it wasn't an urgent need for the actual payment. But imagine if it is and you have businesses going bankrupt waiting for the insurance check. It happens quite often. So they may not want it, but that's where the trend is going. And I think COVID really brought these problems really upfront. So in the US, I think there were something on the order of 20,000 lawsuits just around COVID. That is a pandemic covered? Does
right.
my 700-page insurance contract cover a pandemic or not? And I think there's a big push happening from the consumer side that there's a dissatisfaction that's rising at how things are done. Now, that doesn't mean that all insurance policies are suddenly ready to be settled by data either, right? The data itself has a long way to go in many arenas, right? Health insurance, for example, is not in a state where you can get to some sort of sensor that will cover you. But there are many, many, especially in climate, many, many subsections of insurance that can be settled by data because the data has become more and more granular and clear, and computation power has increased tremendously to allow you to price that using a vast amount of climate data. And so that's where we really focus on, is the variability of the climate is becoming a massive problem across the financial system. And insurance as an industry is not really ready to face that challenge, both from the amount of capital it brings in and the products it has.
Which is so strange, right? Because it's such a, of all the industries in all the world, it feels like it's the most data-driven, right? In that, like, if you get life insurance as a, I'm a 47-year-old male, I weigh this, I'm this tall, I don't smoke, blah, blah, blah. They can kind of say, okay, your risk is X, therefore you must pay Y, right? It feels very granular in many ways.
In some aspects of insurance, yes. But that's not necessarily the case with climate, where there's large gaps and a large gap in understanding. And climate is causing these guys a lot of headaches. And while insurance may be one of the heaviest users of data, Wall Street would trump that. And I was there. And my journey from Wall Street to insurance is not unique. It's happening more and more because the knowledge gained on the financial sector from trading and many of these things that are actually extremely intense users of data, you're starting to make a push against the qualitative underwriting that is present in a lot of insurance.
I'll stop you there and I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but like to your point around the kind of the foundational nature of insurance, I live in California. We just purchased a house. The whole deal almost fell apart because the house, which has been in the same place for 100 years, has been deemed uninsurable, right? So I had to get go through many, very circuitous route to get it insured. And the number of people, friends, who in the past 6 months to a year who have said, my insurance company just dropped me. They're pulling out of California entirely. It's really extraordinary. And this is all, I think, goes back to the wildfires, those two or three very bad years of wildfires and losing, you know, a quarter century of profits as they paid out all those claims. But now you have this whole swathe of these assets, which are borderline uninsurable. And those are the single biggest source of wealth for most people. That is a crisis if it is not resolved.
So California is a great example of what's wrong, right? So one thing that's underappreciated is when you have more frequent storms, each event is a massive cost that goes beyond just that event. There's litigation, there's all sorts of the things that I discussed, the arcane way claims are done, the added costs get added in. So reinsurers are shying away from those because of the more frequent thing. Life insurance is different. There's only one claim in many cases, right? So that's a great insurance use case. But if you're writing insurance for hurricanes that happen once every 50 or 100 years, you're fine. Once you start having events every 3 to 5 years, 10 years, that's a problem. On top of that, it's a highly regulated industry. So in places like California, the regulatory architecture, which determines the price, you're not determining the price in those markets. They're not keeping up necessarily with the rising risks, right? So you get that mismatch, suddenly it's a losing business too. So it's not just the insurer's fault. It's kind of like the whole system needs to evaluate how it deals with far more variability in climate, right? If climate is very stable and you have just a few events, you can just keep on doing what you were doing on rinse and repeat. Now that's becoming very, very difficult.
Yeah. And I think that's what's interesting is like to your point around because I think it's a really good point, is around the regulation. There's a huge fight that's been going on for years now between the industry and the state regulator. You know, this is a state of 40 million people. It's bigger than most countries. And they're saying, you know, you can only charge X or Y. And the industry is saying, okay, well, if that's the case, then I'm just leaving. I'm just pulling out of the state.
Exactly. I mean, how can you even sustain it in that state, right? And that's where data and stuff comes in, is when we thought about parametric products, which is what we call data-driven insurance, it doesn't have to be just the consumer. The insurers are struggling to offset that risk to reinsurers. So we have designed and transacted a lot of parametric reinsurance policies where it's not one house, but it could be 50,000 houses, all, you know, as a portfolio paying on wildfire data on the aggregate, which allows insurers to offset more risk and stay in these places, right? Because if they cannot find reinsurance, if reinsurance industry is shrinking from climate risk, then the insurers actually don't retain much risk.
Right.
They are beholden to the reinsurers. Reinsurance shrinking has caused a lot of these upheavals to then go all the way to the consumer.
Yeah, they're the insurers of the insurance companies, basically.
And so the parametric reinsurance is a way to plug some of those gaps in the climate risk and to find, and it acts as a bridge. When you can make it into a more data-based product, it also makes it into a bridge to alternative capital. Could be a fund, could be a hedge fund, could be a pension fund, could be a lot of new types of capital that need to enter this market. And what's the allure for those capital providers? It's that these assets are uncorrelated to financial markets. So if I'm writing a 100,000 point policy on hurricanes or floods or wildfires, that's at least not related to stock market, bond market, Russia, Ukraine, geopolitical events, things like that. So you have now created a new asset class, which is how we view what we are doing, to enable more capital to come into climate risk than just the usual reinsurers that were already here.
So what is that asset class? How would you define it?
It's financial products that reference climate data.
I see.
Could be temperature, could be rainfall, could be if you're a farmer, I could sell you a contract that says I'll pay you if rainfall around your farm area is lower than X. Or if you're a ski resort, I could sell you a contract that says if snowfall this season is less than 70% of average. We actually work a lot with renewables. Renewables are interesting because there's a whole new industry growing rapidly that is constantly being affected by climate risk. If you run a renewable facility like wind or solar, variable wind speeds and variable sunshine now cause you revenue volatility, now cause you to have less certainty about how many renewable energy credits you'll generate, how many production tax credits you'll generate. That uncertainty then cascades into a higher borrowing cost, more difficulty in getting bank loans. So you have new industries that are actually even more prone to climate volatility. And products like this mean that you can scale coverage for them based on, say, satellite plus station wind speed data or lots of other different data sets to enable them to have a much smoother revenue stream.
What is your kind of secret sauce? Is it access to data that other people don't have? Is it getting just much more data specifically focused around climate and then using some very smart algorithms to kind of turn that into a kind of a risk profile? Like, what is it that you're doing that, you know, a reinsurance company today would not be or just doesn't have, where do you fit or how does it, what is the thing you're doing that sets it apart?
Yeah, we always like to say that it's not any one point of secret sauce because that's generally fleeting. So data-wise, we are agnostic to using a vast array of data. A lot of it can be public. It takes a while to, you know, clean it and process it and get it in the right form. But it's more about using a vast array of data to come to a price for that risk than to use one magical data source, which is true in a lot of finance too. You rarely have one data source. You're more trying to make sense of a vast array of somewhat related data sources. So if you're doing temperature, you know, there will be a relationship perhaps to all the teleconnections like El Nino and all that, which are ocean water phenomenon in different parts of the world. Could be how thick the ice pack is. I'm just naming different features that could be an effect. So it's more about that. It's also technology alone is not enough to solve this problem. It's that this allows it to build a bridge to capital markets. And so one of the other big parts of the edge is that instead of just the traditional reinsurers, we are able to appeal to a much broader variety of capital that could be coming from the Wall Street world, from the reinsurance world, alternative capital, who see the risk reward as beneficial. And that's the challenge also, is like, you know, how do we get distribution from clients that then the pricing for them works and if pricing works for capital. It's, you know, building a set of unique distribution points, bringing technology, and then bringing capital to basically solve the whole process. And that's really where the edge lies.
And your clients, just to be clear, are basically other reinsurance companies. In other words, the insurers of the insurance companies.
No, so that's one piece of our business, is the clients would be the insurance companies looking to offload their risk, where reinsurers are unable to fill in that gap. But a large part of our business actually is also in agriculture and energy, very traditional industries that are
just direct to those companies.
Or where legally required a, you know, local insurance broker who acts as intermediary. But it's the agriculture markets, you know, are obviously very aware of weather risk, and the energy markets, the traditional markets, have temperature as a big driver of demand in local areas.
Yeah.
When it's hot summer, air conditioning, when it's cold winter, heating demand. And on the supply side, the wind and solar growth has been another source of demand for our products.
Right. Got you. Yeah, it's really interesting because also just going back to the California example, and I'm speaking about this because we just experienced it and lots of others that we know are experiencing currently. There's like all of a sudden there's like two companies that no one's ever heard of who are the only ones providing home insurance. And one of them is called like Bamboo Insurance, which is apparently part of a Chinese conglomerate that's never been here before until quite recently. And all of a sudden they're just like, they've come in and they're charging a lot, but they're taking a risk that all these other traditional insurers are just like being like, nope, we're not playing anymore. It feels like there's a lot of big tectonic plates moving in the insurance industry as we speak that, again, most people are probably not paying attention.
Yeah, absolutely. So that the advances in data, the advances in computation, and being able to use techniques like AI, which we've been at it since early days, we're just not an extremely sort of flashy use case of AI with chatbots, but there's a lot of work that goes on in the background to understand that climate risk in a way that a human would have a challenge. And then the capital side, right? All these different aspects are all moving rapidly. Recently, there was articles about how last year hedge funds got involved in hurricane risk. That's all a small piece of a larger trend to find new asset classes, to find new markets, because the traditional financial markets are becoming more and more correlated. So that push, plus the technology push, plus the data push, plus lastly, I would say the clients are far more aware of alternative products and far more aware of the exclusions and growing deductibles in their existing policies.
Yeah.
So we're often not pushing aside anyone. Often the business is, okay, you have a growing deductible or you're just excluded from this particular piece of risk. Let's use a parametric policy to fill that gap while you still have your traditional policy.
Parametric, that's like, it's like basically Armageddon risk or Armageddon insurance, kind of like.
Not necessarily.
When we say parametric, how do you, you know, what does that actually mean?
It means that a data set triggers a payment. So let's say you're a utility. You might buy a contract that says every day in July, the temperature is above 90 degrees Fahrenheit. I want to get paid $1 million. That's a parametric policy. And, you know, there'll be some cap and we'll charge you some premium for that protection, basically.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I want to talk briefly about weather and weather forecasting and understanding weather, because I keep hearing, and it's something I want to dive into at some point, that like the whole weather industry is changing around forecasting and understanding, using kind of AI and big data to kind of get much more granular about weather. I don't know if that is something that you are seeing or if you could speak to, because I keep hearing, you know, even like Google, I think recently released some interesting like weather models that are quite a big departure from how it's been done in the past. But if you could speak about that, because I think it's a fascinating window into what's happening here.
Yeah, and we've been at this for many years now and really kind of been at the forefront of many of these changes happening. You know, when you think about weather forecasting, it's actually, you have to separate into, I think of it as three buckets. Your near-term bucket, which is, let's say, the next 2 weeks of weather forecasting, that's seen rapid advances over the past few decades. The weather forecast is getting considerably more accurate at the seven-day window, for example. And with Google and all these other guys bringing these new AI techniques, those advances will pick up. That's where the realm of physics operates, right? Physics works relatively well, call it up to 1 to 2 week window. Then you start to decline in effectiveness using right. pure physical models. And where we operate is the sub-seasonal to seasonal window. So call it 1 to 9 months out. That's where it tends to become more statistical with some climate dynamics that you still have to incorporate. And so the AI techniques, the work is very different than what you would do in the 0 to 15 day window. And then past that becomes the large scale climate modeling, which is a very different world altogether. And one can argue very different verifiability. So we operate in that seasonal window. And I think, you know, in academia and a lot of these, there's a you'll see a trend of papers that are more and more coming out on this, that, you know, there is a lot of statistical work that can be done to incorporate all sorts of varying trends. And I think AI holds a tremendous opportunity to understand our climate better and forecast it better. Is there going to be a drought this summer? What are the chances of heat waves over the next month? And all these different aspects.
So that 1 to 9 months, I guess I'm trying to understand, like, everybody understands, like, you know, the weather forecast the next week. Okay, I get that. But when you're talking about 6 months out and like the likelihood of floods or wildfires or hurricanes, how accurate is that? Or is it just, this is all just statistics and you're like, well, your chances have gone up by 5% because of what's been happening in the past, you know, year?
That conviction varies tremendously because it's really about, does the climate setup give us a strong signal, weak signal? And so a lot of the work is not in necessarily even particularly forecasting, oh, this area is going to be dry. It's, this area looks drier than usual. And what is the uncertainty band around that forecast? And is it narrowing or is it widening? How narrow, how wide, how wrong can we be, basically? And so you could have a 51% conviction, you could have a 55%. unlikely you're getting over anywhere near 60% that far out, but the setup matters a lot. And, right. In some areas, depending on the oceans and all these other aspects, you could have a much stronger signal. The signal can weaken very quickly as you move this way or that way geographically.
I mean, this is your world, so you're obviously more comfortable with it than I am, but like, it feels like a pretty unsettling thing to do, to be like, especially offering these big insurance contracts where you're like, well, you know, if it's really hot, we're going to pay you $1 million a day or whatever it is, and it might just be really hot or hotter than you expect. And, you know, it's months or years in advance. It feels like it's kind of a crapshoot.
It is a crapshoot. That's you get used to that. I mean, that's you get used to that with trading too. If you trade long enough, and I used to trade commodities, there's always something happening that will not only surprise you, but most likely surprise you negatively.
Yeah.
There's a coup, or there's Fukushima, there's Arab Spring. There's something going on all the time, and you get comfortable with that uncertainty. And the way you have to manage that risk is that more than forecasting, your first and foremost line of defense is diversification. That right. No one area, no one type of risk should take you out.
Right. So can we talk about you for a second? So like you mentioned you grew up in the eastern part of India.
I'm from there. I grew up all over, but less actually there. It was a challenging place in those days to grow up. So partly was South India, near actually the forests. My father was in the forest department there for 20 years. So I grew up around very, very interesting jungles and tea plantations and things like that as the first few years of my life. And then I was in Delhi, came here to Boston.
How'd you end up in Boston?
My father was doing a PhD there. So it was in conservation biology. I grew up right outside Boston in Somerville. From there, I went to Harvard. And Harvard University was obviously a very interesting place, met a lot of interesting people, and basically did applied math and stats there. Bachelor's and master's. Yeah, it was a four-year combined degree. It was intense, but I learned a lot. I ended up in the usual path of Wall Street from there, at the time at least.
When was that? When did you land in Wall Street?
2005.
Oh, so like the last few years of the good old days.
Exactly. And I started in interest rates. You know, it was a good foundation to learn markets. If you can, you know, understand interest rate futures, options, treasuries, macro. But I always loved commodities. So one day I decided I'll just quit and join a tiny hedge fund that I was the first employee in the commodities pod, and said, you know what, I'll learn something totally new. I had no idea about anything about commodities, but it was quantitative, but also fundamental, which is what I liked, that combination. How do you understand the fundamentals of logistics and production, consumption of all these varied commodities? And so, you know, I was like, I learned oil, I learned cotton, I learned sugar, I learned copper, corn, cattle, and traded all of it, and was a fascinating arena. And after a few years, I got the chance to be a portfolio manager at a shop called Castleton. So I was there focused on global agricultural trading, which was a new asset class for them.
Oh, wow.
And then lastly, I was at Citadel Commodities. So doing a bunch of different interesting projects on incorporating machine learning and novel data sets.
Right.
And the variety was always fascinating to me. One day I'm looking at, you know, tracking ships by satellite for commodity flows. Sometimes it's gas pipeline. Sometimes it's satellite for crop yields, modeling power plant fuel usage. So the commodities teaches you very, very quickly about how the world works in many, many different ways. So it was a very fascinating experience across the board.
I used to cover commodities as well, and I knew all the Glencore guys.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was like spent a lot of time with them and covering that company and, you know, going to the furthest reaches of the earth to see what they're actually up to.
Yep. It takes a while to figure that.
It does.
I won't comment anymore.
No commentary necessary. And so when did you leave that and start Arbol?
2018. In addition to Wall Street, I dabbled quite a bit in the satellite space and the blockchain space. As I got more and more familiar with satellites and blockchain, Arbol actually started as a blockchain white paper, a concept paper. And the idea was that if you basically put these parametric contracts in a smart contract, you can basically have an automated code system. So you convert insurance contract into code. So if temperature greater than X, and it would get temperature data,
right.
Smart contract would use an Oracle bridge and all that. In those days, none of this infrastructure worked well. So we created some of it. But also, of course, regulatorily, this was all impossible, but we didn't know anything. So it was good. In a way, it got us to try a lot of things because we were precisely outsiders in this world. And that's how we sort of started to understand this confluence of technology, climate risk, and obviously being on Wall Street, and my team has considerably more experience than I do, many of the team members in that arena. We then got to understand what capital providers want to make that full service solution, because it was just very, very challenging to work with the traditional players at the time.
When you say you dabbled in satellites, what does that actually mean?
I was an early advisor to a group that was attempting to launch one of the first commercial radar satellites. And so I learned a lot about not only the different kinds of satellites and their use cases, but also, you know, what this whole ecosystem looks like and who are the players and, you know, what the different economics look like. And, radar was new at the time. It was mostly a military satellite thing because it was so expensive, but costs were coming down. And I was sort of brought in because of my commodities experience to try to add value on possible applications, of which there are many. So this was something I did almost as a hobby.
Yeah.
I was certainly not paid for it. And it was something where it was like a deep learning experience for me on that space. And, you know, weather has a lot of links to satellite as well. So it was like a lot of that knowledge comes in handy over the years, just having known that space.
Yeah, I think the whole space-based everything is a really interesting kind of area. We've had on this podcast a few times Will Marshall, who founded Planet Labs, you know, taking a photo of the entire Earth's surface every day and selling that to various companies and governments around the world, and then just seeing what's happened with launch costs is really extraordinary.
Yes, yes. It's fascinating. I follow space very closely, and it's amazing also how I always love the confluence of, you know, one piece of technology can then have so many mushrooming effects on so many other pieces. And this is why for me, there's never a question of, you know, I see these comments sometimes on articles about why are we going into space when there's so many problems on Earth.
Yeah.
That's not a relevant thing at all, because space travel, space technology has given us so many benefits here. And it's just going to continue that way.
Yeah. Why'd you call it Arbol? I know it means tree in Spanish, but.
One, being Indian, Indian words are difficult to pronounce for the most part. And you needed a global kind of thing. So that was one issue. When you work globally, you want an easy pronunciation. But for me, I love trees and forests as a, just having grown up around them as a kid. But I view a lot of growth as a branching process. And if you look at how Arbol has grown, it's really about not a linear growth process. It has branched in many, many different areas from where we started and what we were as a blockchain white paper. But we are constantly thinking about how we grow the branches up and the roots down. And, you know, it's a metaphor for just how I think about growth in general.
And so are you still, is blockchain part of your business, because we went almost 40 minutes without saying the word, which is amazing. So thank you.
We don't use it for fundraising purposes. some aspect of our infrastructure that does utilize it. We just always viewed it as a tool. I think there's a value in, for example, our data structures. We actually built a whole decentralized data network of climate data that we spun out of Arbol called DClimate. And many others use it too now. And, you know, when you think about climate data, a lot of weather data gets overwritten as models change. They sit in arcane FTP servers, have huge limits on usage, which is very difficult to use. In some data sets, if you want the temperature data for a single point, you have to download gigabytes of data for the whole world and parse it yourself. There's just a general lack of usability. So we put it all on decentralized servers, and it's immutable record of climate. So every revision gets tracked automatically. So there are benefits that come at it.
So what is Arbol today? Like, how many people are you? And like, how has it been? If you started in 2018, I don't know if it was an AI winter, but it certainly wasn't the summer we're in now. It's a different world, you know?
I never thought of it as AI. I always found AI to be a funny term. It's really just having some academic background in statistics, you're like, well, this was basically stats just on a larger data set. Fine. We want to call it this. You want to call it artificial intelligence. I prefer machine learning, but even that is a little bit of a misnomer sometimes. I mean, we did that almost out of necessity. You just have so many different features and data sets that to deal with to make sense of those patterns. You kind of end up with all types of different machine learning algorithms from your simple regressions to your neural network.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of out of necessity. We're now around 70 people. The first 2 years, we were just figuring out what is even going on. How do we even do the first transaction here? We had some very, very good early investors. You know, we did a seed round way back in end of 2019. Took a year to get that done, trying to figure out even a business plan.
Did Ken Griffin invest?
No, I didn't. Reach out to him for that. But one of our investors is a similarly large fund.
Yeah.
But not Citadel.
Yeah.
But they saw the same thing. It's like there's a new marketplace being born. And that if this is executed well, it could be very large. And the needs are growing significantly. What we try to be very different at is thinking about the use cases very differently. When you talked about parametric, and that was a very difficult conversation back then, there was no example of success, right? Not, you couldn't point to a single firm and say, oh, we are going to follow that trajectory.
Yeah.
And so the insurance world also thinks of damage locally. And so parametric was just used for a lot of often corporate social responsibility. You have a parametric program in an emerging market for a few hundred farmers, and that's your press release. And that's what the mindset was. But if you think of a bank loan, and we're not there yet, we're getting there. But if you think of every bank in the world as being tapped by the central bank to stress test their climate risk, that's just step one.
Yeah.
But if you think of their loans, their infrastructure books, all the assets they own, and you try to think about how will they hedge that climate risk, it will need to be parametric. You know, your million farm loans or a million mortgages can't have that kind of insurance mindset of a subjective loss assessment. So we are headed to a much broader need on a societal system to manage climate risk. And so that's kind of, another example I like to point is if you have a drought in Taiwan, that has a cascading effect on semiconductor chip supply, or a flood in Thailand, this happened a few years ago, caused havoc in auto parts. So you could be an importer in Europe, but you are affected by weather in Thailand. So thinking of climate risk in that global way, you need parametric policies to start to address those challenges. And, you know, we talk about 2018 being so long ago, and it is. It's at the time, even climate risk was just a conversation point, climate change and all these things.
Yeah.
And that has changed massively in the last, I would say, 2 years, especially after COVID. I think COVID woke up everyone to the idea that what seems like a giant, but remote risk that couldn't happen in our time suddenly can happen really, really fast. So it's really changed the conversation in that sense.
And as you say, you're often not replacing, but you're in addition to it. Is the idea then that, like, in this world of more dramatic climate events, life and business is just going to be more expensive?
That's the thing, is that everything will become more difficult and more costly if you cannot manage these risks.
But even managing them will be more expensive, right? You know, just the reality of the situation means that you're going to need more insurance, or it's going to be more expensive. There's more risk.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the other issue, especially in the US, is we get distracted by the cause of climate change and all these things. That's almost an irrelevant point here. You know, and we actually don't even bring that up because that's not at all relevant. It's just that these costs are growing. If even because people are just living in more vulnerable areas, there are people living closer to forests and coastlines and other areas that have more climate risk. So does it matter why it's happening? Absolutely, for some other contexts, but not in this context.
You have all of this data, you know, flowing in through your systems. To your point around kind of just this new reality, how bad does it look? Like, is California going to be vaporized? Is half of Florida going to be underwater? Like, you know, when you think about kind of, you step back and look at the kind of the trend lines as a human, how's it all look?
I'm not in that boat, I would say, which may be odd for a climate insurance CEO. I think that the reality is very complicated, which is not a great answer, but the trends are extremely varied. There are very different trends happening in different places. And I think the issue is that we don't necessarily understand what's happening. So even if you look at the warming trend, it's far more pronounced in the Northeast US than in the sort of West Central US. And you have these, like, if you drew a map, you're like, I don't necessarily understand. I mean, I understand partly, but I don't fully understand what is it that is happening. So in some parts of the world, you will feel like, yes, it's like apocalypse, you know, the heating trend, you know, I mean, in India, where I'm from originally, like, the heating trend is quite pronounced. You know, March used to be pleasant, now it's just increasingly very, very hot. But in other places of the world, you won't feel it. And that's also a very challenging thing for when you want to build consensus. Even stuff like hurricanes, it's actually not necessarily clear from the data that hurricanes are getting worse in all places, in especially when you consider the whole world. But then there's extremely worrisome things like the oceans are getting hotter and hotter each year. So I think the worry with this tends to be the feedback loops. We don't know which feedback loop might trigger something that makes it very challenging for humans to live in certain areas. That's the much worse part.
Yeah.
And we are initiating a lot of feedback loops that we don't understand. The more snow that melts causes certain parts to get warmer, which releases more carbon, which causes more snow to melt, and so on. That stuff is what's challenging about climate. And, you know, I always think, you know, the Earth will be fine. We have to be, we have to figure out how to work with this. So I do think, like, a lot of things, like, our infrastructure is also extremely not climate resilient. We are built for the exact climate we have known for only the last 30, 40 years. In each place. That's why it can snow, you know, a foot in some places and everyone's fine. And it can snow 2 inches in another place and the entire city comes to a halt. Like Sandy in New York. For Florida, that would be a fairly minor storm. And in New York, it caused havoc. We need resilience and we need to have a lot more clarity on how we build society that is not so beholden to a small band of climate data.
And that is all the time we have. I want to thank Sid for taking the time. I want to thank you all for listening, for the ratings, for the reviews, for telling your friends, for telling your neighbors, for telling your loved ones, for telling your enemies and your frenemies about this podcast. It always helps. That is it for me this week. I will be back next week with another fantabulous episode. But until then, take care, take it easy, and give us a rating, give us a review. Just take a moment. It really helps, truly. That is it. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.